You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
I'm Christine Buckley, and this is Field Talk, a podcast produced by the Ecological Society of America. In Field Talk, we explore research by authors who have been published in the Society's journals Ecology, Ecological Applications, and Ecological Monographs. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Jabouri Kazoul, a plant ecologist at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. In the February issue of Ecology, Dr. Kazoul discusses why some trees produce unviable seeds and explains a phenomenon using a theory he calls the sacrificial sibling hypothesis. He joins us today from Zurich. Dr. Kazoul, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In this paper, first of all, you focus on a family of tropical trees, and these trees engage in mast seed dispersal behavior. What is masting, and can you explain to us why these plants behave this way?
Okay, Dipterocarps are the biggest family of, or the most dominant family of trees in Southeast Asia. They really dominate the forest canopies, and they're amazing in many, many different ways. But perhaps one of the most interesting features is that they fruit, or many of them at least, produce flowers and produce fruit in massive synchronous events, which happen once every few years. So individual Dipterocarp trees might produce millions of flowers, but considering that many of these trees within species, as well as many, many species, will all be flowering at the same time, the whole forest turns yellow, whole canopy turns yellow with this huge floral display. That happens very irregularly, perhaps once every few years.
Why do the plants decide to put all of their seed out at the same time?
Well, there are several theories, but the one that's most relevant and most widely accepted, I think, for Dipterocarps at least, is that enormous seed production that follows these massive flowering events exhausts seed predators' capacities to consume all the seed. So seed production on such a scale satiates seed predators, in other words, and allows a larger proportion of the seed to escape than might otherwise be possible.
Do you ever find examples in the wild where one population or one species just gets it wrong, does the math wrong and masts in the wrong year, and then it's kind of really bad for that
yeah.
population?
Oh, yeah, this happens all the time. And in fact, one of the annoying things for us is that most of our work is done during massive masting events. But every year there's a few species that will flower, usually only a few individuals, but that gets us all excited because we think that this is the start of a masting event, and then it peters out.
Is there an element of competition that happens as well when all of these trees are fruiting at the same time?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there are certainly costs to mast fruiting. So for insect pollinated species, as the Dipterocarps certainly are, the synchronous flowering may also exhaust the capacity of pollinators to pollinate all the flowers. The trees may be competing for a limited number of pollinators. There are other costs as well. They may also be competing for the massive resources, the nutrient resources that are required to produce the seed crop. And also it increases the likelihood of self-pollination. If there are millions of flowers to visit within a single tree, then why move to another?
In these Dipterocarps, they can actually pollinate among the same tree as you just described. Is this common in the plant community? And can you describe why it would be beneficial or not beneficial to pollinate yourself?
Yeah, self-pollination is fairly common, but it varies greatly from species to species and even from region to region. So in the tropics, the consensus view, at least up until about 10 years ago, was that the vast majority of tropical trees are outcrossed. In other words, they have mechanisms that actively prohibit self-pollination. So we now know that many of these tropical trees actually do self-pollinate, at least to some extent, and this is certainly true of the Dipterocarps. So some of our experiments have shown that up to perhaps 60% of the flowers in several Dipterocarp species are self-pollinated. So while many of these self-pollinated flowers do not make it to mature fruit, a small percentage do, which increases the seed set and ultimately or potentially the fitness of the tree.
How does a researcher know when the fruit of a tree has been self-pollinated? How do you know that it's 60%?
It requires a lot of experiments, manipulative experiments, where we have to get up there into the canopy and artificially pollinate the flowers ourselves. And then we monitor the progress of development of those flowers. It's very, very laborious. It means climbing up these trees, which are sometimes 60, 70 meters high, and is something that, luckily, I don't do, but my postdocs certainly do. And so there's a lot of work involved, a lot of hard work involved.
The production of many, many selfed seeds has led you to this interestingly named hypothesis that is in the title of your paper, the sacrificial sibling hypothesis. Can you explain what the sacrificial sibling hypothesis means and how you came up with it?
Sure. Dipterocarps do a very odd thing. Firstly, they have very high levels of self-pollination, as we've been discovering in the last few years. And they also invest considerable resources to develop the resulting self-seeds or self-flowers. Now, there's nothing particularly odd about that, except that the majority of these self-seeds are then aborted at a very late stage of development, which is roughly halfway through the maturation process, by which time the fruit has achieved close to its full size at maturity. So a lot of resources are invested in these seeds, and yet they're aborted before they actually reach maturity. Now, this represents an enormous waste of resources, you would think, because these aborted fruit contribute nothing to fitness.
So the selfed seeds are basically filling out the massing process.
That's right. And actually, this is what led us to think that this might not be such a bad strategy for the trees, because the trees the seeds of these trees are being attacked by many, many invertebrate seed predators, mainly beetles and moths, that lay their eggs on the developing fruit within the first few weeks of development. These larvae hatch and eat the seeds from the inside and then pupate and emerge as adults at the time of fruit maturity, about 100 days after flowering. So if these seed predators were unable to distinguish between selfed and outcross seed, then as the number of selfed seed increases, in other words, as the tree continues to invest in the development of these selfed seeds, then the impact of the seed predators on the outcross seed, which are truly the ones that are most valuable from the plant's perspective, will become diluted. Thus, the whole hypothesis proposes that it pays a tree to develop selfed fruit that then act as decoys and dilute the impact of seed predators on the really valuable outcross seed. Selfed seed are retained and perhaps even nurtured as sacrificial offspring or offerings for the preservation of their outcross siblings.
So how does one get started studying Dipterocarp rainforest plants in Asia?
Well, if you're asking about how I got involved in
yes.
it, it was a matter of luck to some extent. So, I mean, after my PhD, I was offered a one-year position to work in the rainforests of Vietnam. And that was really a great experience, as we spent almost the entire year living and working in the rainforest itself. And by the end of the year, I was absolutely hooked. It was really a love-it-or-hate-it experience, and I loved it. But also, I had previously, within my PhD, gained considerable interest in pollination ecology, which Pat Wilmer, my PhD advisor, had introduced me to. So after coming away from Vietnam, I thought it made sense to combine pollination research with tropical forests. And then I was really lucky to be offered a postdoctoral position to do exactly that in Thailand on Dipterocarps. In Thailand, the Dipterocarps we were working on were thankfully somewhat smaller than the Dipterocarps we were working on in Malaysia. So we're talking about 30-meter tall trees. And I could handle that in the sense that we often went up using rope climbing techniques or by building scaffolding towers, and we spent all day and sometimes all night, because some of these things are pollinated at night by moths. But in Malaysia, I just don't have the head for heights to go up to 60 meters, which is what two of my postdocs do, and really I have them to thank for all the hard work.
What do you think is the most exciting thing about the research program that you have right now?
Yeah, well, climbing in the canopy is certainly exciting, but it's not something I'd want to repeat too often. But I guess from an academic perspective, what I find really interesting about the work we do is how ecological questions that we're seeking to answer begin to open up windows onto evolutionary questions and vice versa. So, for example, our sacrificial sibling hypothesis generates further ideas about the evolution and maintenance of selfing among trees. The evolution of selfing is certainly an interesting topic. But perhaps from the perspective of the research process, what I find most exciting are the discussions that we have when we're poring over our research results and data, often over a beer under a tropical evening atmosphere. And that's when the ideas really begin to flow and one thing leads to another, not always successfully, but the process itself is exciting. And this is exactly the way that the ideas behind the sacrificial sibling hypothesis came about.
Do you have any advice for young students, either undergraduates or graduate students, who are thinking about careers in ecology?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is to do something which really inspires you and fascinates you and motivates you. Because if you don't have the genuine deep interest and motivation to to pursue the subject that you're working on, then you're wasting your time, because it is hard work. It's very tedious often. You're working in uncomfortable conditions. It's not easy doing field work, and perhaps academia as a whole. It's highly competitive. But if you're genuinely and deeply interested in your subject and you have the motivation, then I think you can't fail.
That was Dr. Jabouri Hazoul, a plant ecologist at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. You can read more about his sacrificial sibling hypothesis in the February issue of Ecology. I'm Christine Buckley. Thanks for listening to Field Talk.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. For a link to Dr. Catelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.